Welcome to Packet Push It, the data networking podcast where real engineers get together to talk, dissect, and review work life in the networking industry. Again, this week, the virtual workbench has been tunneled via Lisp in a balloon made of data center fabrics and landed in Krakow in Poland at the Euronog conference. Euronog is a networking conference for network operators in Europe. It was about 150 people here, a lot of hardcore nerds. It was really, really cool. Strangely, not one single whiteboard in sight. I've complained to the management, but luckily I brought my virtual whiteboard so we could run some shows with me. This week we're talking to Jan Zors, who describes himself as a guy from Slovenia, an IPv6 evangelist, and he has an awful lot of opinions. Welcome, Jan.
Thank you.
Yeah. He also was involved in the Vodka Lab last night. Seems to have done quite well, but I think he worked on the theory, you know, just to give you the history there. One of the vendors last night said that if you only drink vodka, you don't get a hangover. So we've been having regular lab sessions here after the conference to test it out. And last night, Jan was working on the beer and vodka test scenario. How'd it go?
Well, you can hear it from my voice.
Yeah. And Ivan and I were working on the vodka only scenario. How are we doing this morning, Ivan Pepelniak?
Pretty good, thank you. So the vodka-only theory works better than vodka and beer theory that has been proven. But still the vendor has overpromised.
Yes, the vendor has certainly overpromised. I still don't feel particularly in great shape, but better than might be hoped. All right, so what we wanted to do, chatting to Jan last night, and we started talking about IPv6 and the internet. And then we started talking about tunnels. That was shortly after we'd been visiting the salt mines in Krakow, which, by the way, are pretty amazing, and if you ever come, you must go. But this led us onto a tunnel of onto a discussion around tunnels and mazes and IPv6. So what we wanted to do was record a show which we named How We Managed to Kill the Internet, because Jan has some experience of where IPv6 can fix things and what's wrong with IPv4 and stuff like that. So where do we start?
Well, you know, with IPv6, we can't fix the internet. We can just continue doing what we're doing, because it's just another way of transporting packets. what I'm not very happy with is that we effectively managed to turn the internet into a place with a bunch of tunnels and many translation points, and I think this is not the internet that we were thinking of like 20 or 30 years ago. Right. So what can we do about that? Right? When we were walking, all three of us were walking that salt mines tunnels.
And we knew exactly how a poor IPv6 packet feels when he is shuffled across tunnels across the internet, having to pass all the firewalls.
Yes.
Because, you know, there are firewalls in the salt mine.
Of course they are. And also IPv4 packets. There is no difference. We are stuffing that poor packets into a bunch of tunnels, you know. MPLS, VPLS, PPPoE, PPPoA, 6-4, 4-6, you know. There's just a bunch of tunnels going on. And can you imagine your country being populated with 10 kilometers of tunnels everywhere and 100 meters of open space to choose which way you want to go?
Oh, that sounds like Brussels.
So what we're saying here is at the moment we're talking technologically that IPv6 tunnel packets are nearly always tunneled over IPv4 at this point in time, because most of the internet backbone is still IPv4. We're not dual stacked everywhere that we need to be. But probably even more so that the IETF standards around IPv6 continually talk about IPv4 over IPv6 tunnels, 6RD, carrier grade NAT, and all that sundry silliness. And you're sort of referring to the fact that why isn't the industry realizing that we just need to go back to what the internet was, which is just let's have IPv4 and IPv6 on our routers and let's have public addresses on everything.
Well, you mentioned 6RD. It's a tunneling mechanism. It's it's a wrong way of doing right thing. Okay, so you can set up the IPv6 service to the customer CPE, but in a wrong way, because you're using IPv4 blocks to carry the packets around. Okay, so with 6RD, if you don't have the incentive to go to pure IPv6, it is there to stay, and it's a tunneling mechanism. You have MTU issues, you have all this all this sort of stuff that is not going really well. Okay,
maybe Jan, just for the younger listeners of this show, let's do a quick overview of why tunneling is bad.
Can you do it?
Let's try it. Yeah.
Okay.
So you already mentioned MTU issues.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We all know that the other problem is the visibility.
Okay. Yeah.
Because if you have packets inside a tunnel, you really can't do whatever your security policy is on the payload in the tunnel. Because if you want to do that, you need to decapsulate, inspect, re-encapsulate into a different tunnel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One other thing that, by the way, came out of the VXLAN discussion is load sharing.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Because you cannot reorder packets inside a flow usually, because you don't know whether the application is order sensitive or not. So everyone in the industry does the same thing, which is load share between flows, not inside a flow. Yeah. And with the tunnels, everything looks like one single flow.
Yep.
So you can't load share.
And you can't cross it. So if you want to say, if your traffic is going across the internet, and you're trying to say, let's say you're a carrier who says, I actually want to deprioritize BitTorrent and give HTTP some priority because it's more time sensitive than BitTorrent is. But if it's encapsulated inside a tunnel packet, you can't shape it because you don't actually have the data around what is the payload.
But why would we like to introduce quality of service on the internet? That's what ATM wanted to do, and it failed miserably. Internet is just best effort. Transport.
Okay. Jan, there are two. I agree with what you're saying. I hear what you're saying.
Okay.
He's got a point.
Yes. Yes. And for the listeners who didn't get the joke yet, please go to Greg's blog and go through 8 steps of vendors saying yes.
It depends. you forgot to include it depends.
It depends. Or maybe I'll have to fix it.
Anyway, so yes, I agree with you that internet as a generic worldwide transport cannot and maybe even should not provide a different classes of service. It's debatable, but yes, I'm there with you. The same technology is used in either intra-carrier networks, where they offer internet and something else, whatever that else is, for their other services.
Okay.
And the same technology is used inside an enterprise network, where quality does matter.
I agree with that.
So when we say quality of service is not important, it's not important in the bigger picture of transporting packets across the globe.
Yes.
Yeah. Some other things about tunneling is it also leads to suboptimal paths. Because when you define a path from point A to point B, and then you put things into that pipe, and then the network changes.
You can't decide on the way.
That's right.
You can't turn on the next crossing left if your tunnel goes straight.
Would the tunnel make sense when you first built the network? But networks don't stay the same. They change.
Yeah.
They adapt. Yeah. New cables, new routers, new pathways. We grow them, we prune them, we add to them. And if everything sits in a tunnel, there's no guarantee it's taking the most optimal path to the destination.
Yeah.
Now, your carrier may well be shifting your traffic down the worst possible path,
mm-hmm.
but you don't know, because the tunnel is defined to go down this path that suits the carrier, not the user of the service.
And there's proven fact, we have data on that if earthquake happens, internet-style network will survive with no disruptions, and tunneling-style network, well, the routing, dynamic routing protocol would just do its work, but the tunnels would fail.
Yes.
Miserably. Because they need to be re-established when the underlying routing protocol decides to go on a different path, then the tunnels just die. And
well, yet again, let me re-qualify that a bit.
Okay. I'm opinionist by profession, so yeah.
I know.
Feel free.
There are two ways you can build tunnels. One is that you totally decouple the infrastructure from the application.
We are now talking about MPLS, right?
Now, if you decouple the infrastructure from the application,
yeah,
and you run everything over IP in the core, then the tunnels behave just like any other application. Yeah. And you have the optimum routing in the core, and as long as the core is stable, your tunnels are stable. What you are referring to is the things where the tunnel has to establish a state across the core.
Yeah.
Like MPLS traffic engineering, where the tunnel has to be signaled through the core because there's a tight coupling between the tunnel head end and everyone else in the tunnel path. And yes, if that thing crashes, then all the head ends are affected and the head ends have to re-establish the tunnels because they're tightly coupled to the core.
How bad is that?
It depends on what you need. You see, no, going back to the, let's say, old ATM or frame relay days, if you just want to shift, to send traffic from point A to point B.
And the easiest way is to set up a tunnel.
If you just want to send the traffic,
okay,
then you use IP encapsulation and you don't care what happens in the middle.
Yeah.
But if you want to, let's say, take advantage of the alternate paths that wouldn't be used because they are not shortest paths, then you need the tight coupling like you need it with ATM virtual circuits or frame relay DLCIs. And in that case, obviously, you need to set up a hop-by-hop tunnel. You have to have the edge tightly coupled to the core. And we know what happens with that. I mean, frame relay networks would behave as well under earthquake conditions as MPLS or ATM networks.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't cheat the physics.
Yeah. It was done like that and it failed miserably. The other point is translation. NAT. Why we had to do that?
Well, you know my theory on that. My theory is that NAT was to make IPv4 possible, because you could have, instead of actually routing traffic, you needed to tunnel NAT, or you need to find a way to hide the IPv4 addresses. So we put MPLS tags in. Most people implemented MPLS so that they could have overlapping RFC 1918 address ranges. Later on, they turned it into something else, but that was the primary purpose of MPLS in the early days.
Yeah, but if we go back to NAT, really the reason NAT was invented 20 years ago is because the industry was too lazy to implement IPv6 on time.
Yeah.
And 20 years later, the industry is still too lazy to implement IPv6 on time.
That's right.
I mean, MPLS, they're introducing another layer of NAT, which is called carrier-grade NAT.
Yeah.
Or the A plus B. That is similar hack.
Yeah.
It's a hack. It's a bad thing to do, but it's lesser evil than carrier grade NAT.
Now that Jan brought this up, he is one of the authors of this horrible hack.
Yes. I'm the co-author of A plus B, yes.
Yeah, so he is. So today we have one of the authors of the RFCs in the show.
Yeah.
And so now that we got to this topic, please, Jan, tell us what A plus B is all about.
Well, A plus B is the answer to CGN. The authors of this A plus B stuff, Randy Bush, Olaf Meidel, Nokia guys, Juniper guys, We just don't like the translation mechanisms, and we think that carrier grade NAT is carrier grade evil. I never write in my presentation, I never write down the word NAT. I write the word evil. And if you build a carrier grade evil, then the name tells everything. So what we thought was, how can we still preserve the public IP address on the edge at the customer CPE, put the same IP address to several CPEs, and give the port ranges to each one of them? This is called, you know, the port range routing. The basic idea is to have port range router in the core and do the V4 encapsulation into V6 packets, carry them to the CPE, and assign different ports to different CPEs.
So
it is 40 pages of RFC. 40 pages. We were writing that for 2.5 years. I did the signaling and the overall architecture part. I'm really happy that I got involved with that, mm-hmm. because I learned a lot. Mm-hmm. We are introducing the state in the core.
Yes.
We are introducing tunnels. That's life. You know, you need to choose the lesser.
The important part here is that the IPv4 address given to the customer may well be shared between, say, street. Yeah. A whole street might have one IP address.
Yeah.
But then each household gets a range of 1,000 ports or something, whatever it might be. Okay.
Dynamic allocation.
So now that has benefits for real people because of security. So today, the only way that we, when you hit your online banking, the only way that they can validate the source is to put a cookie down in your web browser.
Yeah.
That cookie then goes down in the web browser, becomes a security issue because it's no longer issued by the bank. What the banking software, or what we need on the internet from a security point of view, is we need that public IP address to say this is the source. And we need to know that that IP address only comes from one place, that it's unique and identifiable. And that broke mm-hmm. that security challenge, right?
Yeah.
So what you're effectively saying is, I know that there's this gives that unique destination.
Yes, we are still working on that. This will be probably the same amount of work as IPv6 evangelism, mm-hmm. because we need to raise the awareness of the content providers, of the server owners, to start logging the source port. Because with CGN in place and with A+P, same problem. IP address is not a unique identifier of a user in certain point in time.
Yeah.
Because if you have the timestamp and if you have IP address, 60,000 people can lie behind that IP address, right? If you don't, if you are a bank,
yes.
and if somebody does a bad thing to you, if you report only the IP and the timestamp, the operator cannot find the guy.
No.
Okay, Jan.
So you need to log the source port.
So Jan, what you're saying is that today every customer mm-hmm. has an IP address that can change,
yes.
but at a certain point in time we know who had which IP address.
Exactly.
And so we can uniquely identify a customer mm-hmm. from a service provider who was doing the bad things.
Yes.
However, that doesn't apply to enterprise networks.
Why?
Because in an enterprise network, I have one or a few public outside addresses,
okay.
and I have hundreds of users.
Yes.
So the only thing that the law enforcement can do is identify the organization that has tried to break into a bank.
Yes, and then it's your decision if you will hunt down the guy who did that, or If you identify the organization, then you can shift the blame.
Yeah. You can say, so we are in the blame shifting exercise. Yeah.
No, that's all about blame shifting.
Yes.
That's all about finger pointing game, you know. If you introduce the carrier grade NAT in the core, right, you're a service provider, and I'm the bank, and one of your users breaks into my bank, by law today, I am obligated to say IP address and timestamp. Mm-hmm. Where was that IP address at that time? On your CGN.
Yeah.
And on the box in your core. And you are to blame. 10 million euros stolen, you will pay them to me.
So the only thing I can do as a service provider today is to give the law enforcement a list of 100 users that were using that IP address, ask them to hunt all 100 of them down and figure out what they were doing at that time.
If you introduce CGN, probably, theoretically, it can be 64,000 something, right?
But you know it's like 100.
Maybe even more.
Yeah.
But what we entered the hole here. That's a black hole of law enforcement, right? So sharing the address is not really, really very good idea, but you just need to choose lesser evil.
Right? Yeah, so the carriers are now responsible for in carrier-grade NAT. They must still track the source. They've actually, while not investing in their networks to do something to solve the problem, they've actually shifted the cost into logging.
Yeah.
So they now have to log every IP address and everything.
Actually, that's easy. I know in Apache you just add one parameter.
Jan, that is the content provider side.
Yes.
And so the message
where we need to
the message to the content providers is
log the port.
Log the source port, otherwise you will not be able to identify the bad guy.
Exactly.
But let's move now to the carriers.
Okay.
Carrier grade NAT obviously has to log every TCP flow.
And it has to log lots of logging.
Has to log every NAT translation. Otherwise, you are not able to identify the outside IP address plus the source port to the inside IP address, which is the user. So effectively, with carrier-grade NAT, instead of improving the network, service providers are investing that money into logging capabilities.
Into disks.
Yes.
Mm. Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah. Or tapes.
And
plus, it's an administrative problem. It becomes a log. You know, the systems that you have to build to capture those logs and then to centralize them.
I had quite a long discussion with Dan Wink about this. You know, Dan is he's the NAT guy, Cisco, and we found out that with A plus P and CGN, probably it can be defined that it's the same amount of logging, because CGN can be set up in a way that it allocates continuous sets of ports to one user. So you just say, okay, from port this to port this, okay, IP is in the core, but these ports are belonging to that user. But I don't believe that many people will set up CGN like that. They will just say, okay, we have 100 IPs, we don't care.
Yeah. IPNet inside, IPNet outside. Yes. Go!
So, and then log the syslog.
And this would create a massive amount of logging. With A plus P, you can still do the massive amount of logging if you do lots of dynamic port allocations. But what we found out was basically why 40 pages? Because there was lots of questions at IETF. And one of the questions was source port randomization, right? If I give you from ports from 1,000 to 2,000 on one IP, then you have less entropy for source port randomization. So DNS attacks can be very effective on your way of transporting things. So we introduced the idea from Timo Savolainen and Gabor Baiko from Nokia. It is about allocating ports, not random ports, but ports through all the range with a key. So you send a key to a CPE, and the CPE calculates the ports that are spread across the whole range and start using them. This is a crypto key mechanism that is, I was told, it is used by banks to issue credit cards. You can mathematically fill all the 64,536 ports with a set of keys, right? Yeah. You can actually fill that space there.
Yeah.
And if you send the key, and the CPE calculates his ports, you have just to log the key. When the law enforcement comes, saying who was on that IP address from that source port, you just have to calculate it from the keys at that point in time.
And you'll know which one of the users on the AB system that it was.
So you can severely reduce the log.
So you actually don't need to log, you just log the keys.
You log the keys, yes. So the
and that represents a whole bunch of port ranges dynamically spread across the available. Yes.
And you have the entropy, because you have ports across the whole range. You have the entropy to for source port randomization, and you're done. With A plus P, you leave the public IP address at the CPE.
Mm-hmm.
One of these guys, the lucky guy, who signs up and pays a bit more to the carrier, can have well-known ports from 0 to 1024. One guy on the same IP can run servers at home.
Yes.
How cool is that?
Mm.
With CGN, what can you do?
Nothing. Yes.
No
chance of a service.
Yeah. And why we thought about A plus P was because, you know, you need to leave the way you communicate must be in users' hands, right? If you want to do NAT, do NAT in the CPE, not in the core.
Yeah.
Right. CGN is all about locking the users in a walled garden, no? Because if you use some weird protocol to connect to your job, remote desktop, something,
Yeah.
What it can be, whatever.
Unicorn remote desktop.
Unicorn remote desktop. Yeah. For example, today you can switch off NAT in your CPE. You get one IP address, and you have direct communication to the server that is at your job, and you can run very weird protocols across. Right? What happens if your carrier introduces the carrier grade NAT in the core? Would you ring this guy and say, "Hello, Mr. Big Telecom, can you please introduce the ALG into your carrier grade NAT just for my custom application?"
Yeah.
You know what would happen.
So, of course, the only thing that you can do then is create a tunnel, like a VPN tunnel. And then you get all the problems of the VPN tunnel. You have MPU issues, you get suboptimal routing, then you have to...
So what we wanted to do is preserve at least a possibility to end-to-end communication, right? Because an application, if it is aware of the ports, you can probably do a bridging hack in the CPE, put the public IP address on your machine, on your host, and if the host is A plus P aware, it can find the ports to communicate end to end without translation, without port translation, without anything.
So this also has advantages for things like IP telephony. So today, things like Skype have to use a thing called STUN.
Yeah.
And there has to be master nodes on the internet.
Yeah.
In other words, Skype, when you fire up your Skype client, because no inbound connections can be made to your machine, you have to actually punch an IP address out, which creates a state in all of the NAT engines between you and the end, so that the other client can then come back down that same connection to you. The problem with setting up a Skype-to-Skype call in that circumstance is there has to be a master node for the two Skype clients to talk to blow a NAT tunnel through their respective carrier-grade NAT services, right?
How many complexity can we still add?
Yeah. And work. And that's the problem, is that with Skype now, the master node now knows everything that's going on. And if those master nodes go down, and this is what happened with Skype some time ago, is that their master nodes for all of the STUN tunnels that were effectively being created actually collapsed because there wasn't enough of them. And then the Skype network failed.
And this is probably the reason that Skype did not implement IPv6 yet, because they are very good in bypassing complexity, and NATs, and all this stuff, right? So, in IPv6, the idea is to have end-to-end connectivity, end-to-end addressability, all that beautiful stuff that we thought about when we created internet at the beginning with IPv4, but we were able to mess it up seriously. Yeah. With IPv6, we are trying to restore all that, and probably Skype has not implemented IPv6 yet because they lose their competitive advantage, because there is no complexity to bypass and to punch the holes into all that mechanisms, right?
Yeah.
And that's probably, I can't think of any other reason why these guys did not implement IPv6 yet. Because, I'm running around the world. I usually, what I do is IPv6, PDP context over mobile network. Because in Slovenia, we deployed IPv6 on two mobile networks.
Yeah.
It's production grade, and it works in roaming mode. So wherever in the world I am, I can do the IPv6 in roaming mode to our Slovenian provider, and everything works, sort of, because there is NAT64 on the other side, sort of works, but Skype does not work because they don't recognize IPv6, and it just doesn't work. So yeah. This is the only application
that breaks.
Their
protocols
are
so proprietary, and so they would have to rewrite their code to be able to make that happen.
I have no idea, but hey, guys, if Skype guys, if you're listening, please do it.
Yeah, I can't talk to you, Jan, because you can't get Skype to it.
Yeah.
so the only way we can interview him is if we actually sit down, because he doesn't use Skype.
Yeah, but next time we talk to Jan, we'll need to do it before the Vodka Lab.
Why?
You're looking a bit shady.
Now that you mentioned global, I understand why that looks cool to you. I understand why that looks cool to the academics. I understand the benefits to a regular consumer. But this thing makes the enterprise people extremely nervous, because they got used to
hiding
and not being exposed on the internet. I will not even try to go into the PCI requirements. That's a different story. But just the idea of exposing my internal infrastructure to the internet makes a lot of people extremely nervous.
Here, what I can say about this is,
get used to it.
No. People need to think about learning security, okay? Now, we introduced NAT, and people think of NAT as a security measure. Hell, it's not. It's a translation mechanism. It is not a security mechanism.
It's reducing security. My point is that you think it's increasing security, but it's not. It's false, because...
That's a false sense of security.
That's right. So it's like having a PO box to send your mail to so that people don't get your address. Your address is still listed in the yellow pages.
NAT, in terms of security, is like that bird that sticks the head in the sand.
Yeah.
Its vital organs are still
your
outside.
Your ass is still hanging in the breeze. You haven't increased security. And just to talk about that as a fallacy, is just because people don't know, can't identify the exact machine, they can still identify the exact organization. Yeah. So if there needs to be legal retribution or some sort of legal action, they go to the company. And the company is the legal entity, not the individual. And so then it's up to the company to then track down the individual behind the NAT to make good on any legal contract that was entered into. Now, also with that is, once your machine makes a connection out, and even if you've used NAT, the security problem then becomes the machine to the destination.
Yep.
You can't, that security problem still exists. NAT didn't hide you. Once your web browser is connected to the web server, you're now able to download a virus or malware or anything, right? NAT doesn't solve that challenge.
But many people think that if they're behind NAT, they're safe. They're not.
If you're behind a firewall, that has NAT, you are safe, but not because of NAT, but because the firewall stopped inbound connection.
Yes.
It's not NAT that makes you secure.
But you need to know. You need to know how to set up a firewall. If you disable the firewall and use only NAT, then you are in the same place as before. Problem is that people think they're safe behind the NAT. All of a sudden, IPv6 came and will everybody on in the internet be able to print to my printer? Yes, if you're stupid enough.
Yes.
So people are afraid of learning, relearning security, right?
And this time, I totally agree with both of you, which is amazing. Today, what we have in the IPv4 world, and this is primarily applies to the consumers, is I just turn on my CPE, it does NAT automatically. To be honest, NAT in a port translation mode is equivalent to a stateful firewall that does the port level inspection.
It's just hiding.
Yeah, I agree with
security
that. But
by
it is,
security.
It is equivalent to a certain firewalling functionality.
Okay.
We can go into the details of consumer-grade NAT, where you only do lookups on the source port and, and address, or we have like what Yahoo, I think, calls enterprise-grade NAT, which is what Cisco has, where you match source and destination port and address, which is more secure. But still, it is equivalent to a certain firewalling functionality. What we need, what the vendors need to do today on the V6 side is to enable that same functionality by default in V6 CPE. So that a stupid user that has no idea what firewall is still gets the same functionality he got on the IPv4 side and the same level of miserable but still some protection.
There is a work going on at IETF, there is a draft of RFC about simple security in CPE.
Mm-hmm.
And it defines, I think the guy from Apple is the editor of the document, it defines preset default security port blocking and protocol blocking stuff that must be set by the operator when he's shipping the CPE, right? It must be set by default there.
Yeah.
There is also ongoing work on advanced security in CPE. So this is a different draft. I think if we implement that, we did quite a lot of work there.
Absolutely.
In IPv4 world, you just block everything and enable everything on outside. That's a NAT mode. Right.
Yep.
In IPv6, if you block RCMP packets,
even neighbor discovery doesn't work.
You kill patent your discovery and bang, you're down. So
people have to be a lot smarter.
Yeah,
we have to think a bit more carefully about it. But
I really hope that we don't reinvent NAT in IPv6, because really there is no need for that.
Actually, although I yet again agree with you.
Wow, that's an amazing amount of agreement here.
There is an actual burning need for NATty behavior.
NAT 6.6, yeah.
Yeah, and the reason to explain to all the NAT haters out there listening to us, if you, as a small organization or a home user, if you have two internet connections and you get IPv6 prefixes from both internet providers, the hosts today are too stupid to figure out which address to use for outgoing sessions. It's not unsolvable, but the problem is that today's protocol stacks in every operating system available cannot detect which of these prefixes actually works. And I know there are like happy eyeballs draft.
It's implemented.
Where?
I think Chrome implemented it in the last version. It's implemented in Safari. mm-hmm. partially in Safari, partially in Mac OS, the last one. Then I think it's implemented in Firefox. Well, at least it was, but I think they turned it off in the last version because there was some problems with that, the implementation. I really think that Happy Eyeballs is a really good idea.
It is.
Because I personally know both the authors, Andrew Yurchenko and Dan Wink, and we had the Happy Eyeballs buff in Prague at IITF meeting, and that was a really good one. Because, the idea behind Happy Eyeballs is, today you want to reach the page out there, right, the URL, and you ask DNS, and DNS gives you back quote A and A record as an answer. Mm-hmm. So what is the default behavior until now? Try on IPv6 first. The IPv4 guy in your machine is just sleeping. And if you don't get the traffic back on IPv6 after 1 minute or something, you fall back to IPv4, mm-hmm. and your IPv4 guy in your machine starts communicating with the world. Well, Happy Eyeballs is all about both guys in your machine starts communicating at nearly the same time. The biggest question was, what is that deal time that you have to introduce for the IPv4 protocol to start a bit later? Yeah. And I think it's about 300 milliseconds now.
Okay.
The number. So, you start on IPv6, 300 milliseconds later, you start on IPv4.
Yeah.
You do the request, and on the protocol that you receive back the traffic first is a winner. So you disable the other one, and you are communicating on the protocol that won. And that is very simple and very brilliant idea.
Yeah, but that is implemented in a specific
in a browser.
Yeah. Yes.
It must be implemented in OS.
So because the socket API is broken and because the TCP stack is broken.
I knew this would come up at some point in time.
We have to implement hacks in the applications.
Yeah.
To make things work, which should have been solved 20 years ago.
Let's just go back to that. I mean, the answer that the reason why that works is that a while back, Microsoft implemented it so that IPv6 was the first protocol, but it would wait for a timeout interval, and it was like 5 seconds or something, wasn't it?
No, you have to wait for TCP session timeout.
That's right.
Which is, like Jan said, minutes.
Yeah, it did vary a bit. So the simple idea of saying IPv6, 300 milliseconds ahead, and then IPv4 request coming out at some point slightly later means that the user doesn't turn it off.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't have to wait for a DNS timeout or a TCP timeout. They both happen. And there's a very good chance that IPv6 request will come back most of the time.
Yeah.
And so effectively, you're actually using it. But what you're also doing is generating IPv6 traffic. So people who have IPv6 services mm-hmm. will tend to get used.
Yeah.
So it drives a whole positive cycle of adoption and enforcement. And
It's a very simple idea, but yet brilliant.
Happy Eyeballs. I'll put a link in the show notes.
Yeah. Moving forward, well, back to my netty
argument.
Okay. You have the same problem in IPv6 space because you get two prefixes from two ISPs. You use them both to number your hosts. So your host has two perfectly valid global IPv6 addresses. And if you use one address, the return traffic is coming through one path. If you use the other address, the return traffic is coming through the other path. And so we would need something like Happy Eyeballs on the IPv6 side, trying using both source addresses simultaneously.
Probably this could work. But I'm trying to remember, there was at one IITF meeting, there was a buff from Ole Trohan from Norway. It was, what was that? IPv6 multi-homing without BGP.
Yes. I don't remember the details, but it was along these lines.
Yeah.
It is either this or you do NAT66 in the CPE.
Yes, to avoid NAT66, he figured out how to do multi-homing without BGP, and it was not, I don't remember, I would have to ask Ole what was all that about, but there is a way to do multi-homing without BGP.
Unfortunately, no. The problem is that you can't change the TCP, you can't change the OS stack. Mm-hmm. So you have to do a nasty trick, a clutch, like the clutches we've seen yesterday in the mine, like pillars of wood supporting, platforms supporting pillars supporting platforms.
That was complex.
Well, you should put that picture in the podcast notes. Yeah. So users will really understand how tunneling worked in the old days and the layered architectures. Anyway, so you can't do this in the host. You could theoretically do this in the browser, or you could do it in the CPE device. And the CPE device, one other option is the CPE device measures the availability of both upstream paths and then propagates only one or the other prefix to the host. So actually, you use one ISP as primary, one as backup, and when the primary fails, you renumber your internal network immediately.
Wow.
Yeah, sorry, that's the only thing that works.
Well,
that works sort of okay, and it wouldn't be any worse than what we have today. The problem I see is that this isn't implemented anywhere in any device that I'm aware of today, which means that early adopters, and I mean, we shouldn't be speaking about early adopters because we ran out of IPv4 addresses.
Yeah. Hmm.
So the early adopters that want to be multi-homed on V6 are either stuck or they go all the way and get an AS number and PI prefix and pollute the global BGP table.
Yeah.
Yeah. Everybody who has 5 minutes of spare time can pollute the global
BGP table.
Yeah.
And everyone else...
Enter the secure BGP discussion.
Oh, you want to go into that? Well, you know, BGP was done with fairness in mind. So, you know, people that run BGP cannot be bad. That's a presumption that BGP protocol has.
Well, it's like law enforcement.
Yes.
Innocent until proven guilty.
Yes. So, you know, and then YouTube and Pakistan Telecom thing happened. You know about that?
Yes.
You heard about that?
Yeah. Okay.
So now we have this thing, RPKI, going on. Randy Bush is coming to Slovenia in November. He will run the hands-on workshop, how to secure your BGP. It's basically about signing your BGP announcements. So if people can verify your announcements, they will install the route from your announcement with a higher priority.
Yes.
That's basically the thing.
Effectively, what you're saying is you're going to sign a BGP announcement
with
your crypto certificate.
And it's verifiable.
And everybody who receives those routes can then get the public key and validate that the route has been legitimately signed as being coming from your destination. So therefore, if somebody injects, there's nothing just, the fallback position, of course, is that BGP today, anybody who injects a route, BGP route, tagged with an AS is automatically trusted. So if I decide to poison my country by injecting somebody, you know, into the AS to point to somewhere else, BGP inherently trusts that and it propagates worldwide. There's no way, there's no RPF.
Well, there are filters, but not everybody...
Not implemented by lazy operators who don't have a clue.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of operators don't have the a carrier who can't create an invoice accurately.
So we're going down that path. Oh, please continue.
you can't trust a carrier, right? So if a carrier can't produce you an invoice that accurately summarizes what the services they're giving you, if they can't give you a service which is guaranteed to be 99.9% uptime and then tell you the pathway that it goes, how can you trust them to be correctly administering their BGP routing table?
Well, you know what? The provider that I use at home as a residential user, they have 100% accuracy of doing the builds. Mm-hmm. But I measured 97.89% of uptime. Because I run the Atlas probe from RIPNCC at home, so I just log into my administration page of Atlas probe and I have there my uptime of my home down to two digits.
Yeah.
Residential user who knows uptime, yeah, up to two digits.
Well, the point I'm trying to make is the operational assumption is that your carrier is incompetent, because that's the proven statistic in my view. And this is a global thing. That's what, you know, there are going to be cases of certain carriers who are well organized or are well organized in a particular area. You might find one that's got a particularly good MPLS implementation this year, but next year they might not, because the guy or the team that was running that might have broken down, or someone left, or they might have run out of money, or the carrier's financial position changed, or, you know, they added something to the network, and there's no, you cannot say that that they're good generally. Most carriers are incompetent as a general rule. When we talk about, when I hear people say, oh, well, we can use BGP because they all trust each other, that's also assuming that they're all competent, grown up, intelligent, because they're not. So the idea behind secure BGP is that every carriers can choose to sign certificates and sign the BGP routes.
Yeah.
And then you receive them into your router, and you can then validate that that signature is correct, and then load them in and say, these are trusted parts. I'm getting routes that have been signed by somebody to be with
the
a broker.
Only problem with this is, where is the anchor of trust?
That's right.
So the guy who will handle the anchor of trust, the
organization,
the repository, he will probably own the internet. Yes. It's like assigning the root DNS.
And the problem starting that you have today is that the tension between America and China.
Yeah.
The natural place for that is America, because that's who owns the IP address allocation and the DNS infrastructure today. Mm-hmm. It's a military thing. But the Chinese don't want America to have any more control of the internet. In fact, not only America, but a lot of countries are saying it has to be. So who owns that root key?
Yes, but if they're trying to use ITU to get that, they're doing it very wrongly.
Yes, why? Enter the ITU.
We try to keep ITU out of the internet, and I'm sorry to say that. They, you know, I'm very glad they created telephony staff and things like this. But please, please, leave internet alone. Mm-hmm. Don't turn internet into telephony system.
Yes.
Please, just don't.
Yeah. It's far more fluid and far more dynamic than telephony ever will be. And even with the telephony system that the ITU designed, it was still little islands of functionality.
Yeah.
You know, the telephony system that was ITU certified in Australia could not talk to the telephony system in America because they used different standards.
Yeah.
They had to drop down to tip ring phone systems to get interoperability, for goodness sake.
Can you, I will use some points from Randy's presentation from 2008. He was presenting here at PLNOC. And, you know, can you imagine running a telephony system on the internet, like SIP, right, VoIP stuff, versus the non-complexity of the internet, where you have fast switching core and smart edges. On the internet, if you want to implement the new functionality, the new service, you just distribute the application around, and the application starts communicating over the very fast switching core. On the other hand, can you imagine adding a new service on a VoIP system? How complex can we get?
It takes years.
It takes years, and well, lots of, you know,
that's why telephony hasn't changed in 30 years. And we still sell legacy PABXs that were designed 25 years ago.
Yeah.
Still using TDM backplanes.
Centralization is a telco thing. It's not an internet thing, right? And if you centralize stuff, you're just disabling your possibility add new service easily. So you need to invest more and more money into adding new services. How bad is that? Right. Instead of running very simple and fast switching core and put all build the intelligence into the edge, right?
And this is, comes back around on the tunneling discussion where we started.
Yes.
Because tunneling is about centralization.
Yes.
Because ultimately, the state of a tunnel, if you have a tunnel like an MPLSTE tunnel, which everybody seems to be so excited about, which is still the stupidest idea. Yeah. I mean, RSVP failed. RSVP failed for lots of very good reasons.
Yeah.
That also requires coherence and centralization and stops the distribution of intelligence and creates complex cores and complex state and fails.
Well, Greg, the database people know the CAP theorem, which says that you can't really have distributed databases if you want to have transactional consistency.
Mm-hmm.
We have something very similar in networking. If you want to have things like traffic engineering, fast reroute that always works, then you have to tightly couple the edges with the core.
Mm-hmm.
Like we did in frame relay, like we did with ATM, like we did with MPLS.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't have your cake and eat it at the same time. You have to choose one or the other.
Yeah. Well, my favorite rant, which you've heard several times, is that carriers should stop trying to put lipstick on a pig. Right? Because it's still, they should just give up. They should realize that their core business is bandwidth. And instead of trying to engineer a network to run SMS messages and then add and then charge for that, they should just say, right, we transport IP, we dig holes in the ground, and we put cable into them, we put things in the middle that connects the cables together, and we go really, really fast. If we just had more bandwidth instead of dicking around with MPLS and tweaking this and QoS that, DPI this, tunnel that,
over something, over something,
over something, having peer, you know, and just say, well, we peer everywhere, have hundreds of peering points in the network, thousands of, you know, we're in every single town, so let's just peer our networks together in every single town that we're in. If they just focused on delivering that service instead of trying to maximize it and then layering complexity on top of it, their businesses would be profitable. Stop pretending that running TV over the top of the cabling infrastructure is actually worth doing because you make more money. You might make more revenue, but you make less profit because of the complexity of delivering that service.
You make less revenue because lots of money goes to your favorite vendor.
No, you make more revenue but less profit.
Less profit.
Yes.
Yeah, because less profit, because you pass the profit to the vendor who has to deliver a complex thing.
Yeah.
And which brings me into my favorite trend. Thank you. This is exactly why vendors are promoting layer 2 vMotion between data centers.
Yes.
Because they need to create complexity to get more of your profits into their pockets.
Yeah. Yes.
So telco thinking and telco demands to the vendor for complexity is slowly killing the internet. Because, you know, telcos think telephony. And they're trying to introduce the telephony into the internet. But what makes the internet go around today are telcos connected between each other. And, you know, probably we can't change the telco thinking. Maybe it's time for these big companies slowly to go out of their business. We have lots of small ISPs that are very fast, that are implementing IPv6. In our country, in Slovenia, our incumbent is very advanced, and they are implementing IPv6 next month, or in 2 months, I think.
Mm-hmm.
They will do IPv6 to the residential users. If you're a business customer, you get IPv6. There are many, many big telcos around the world that say, okay, we will not implement IPv6 because this is a cost. We heard some of them yesterday,
yes,
right?
Exactly.
And, you know, maybe it's time for this sort of organizations to slowly close down the business and go somewhere else.
I think that's a great point to wrap this up. So that's it for the show, and thanks for listening to Packet Pushers. We should be back again in a week or so. We look forward to hearing you come back. I'd like to thank Jan Zors for coming on the show. Jan?
Thank you.
Where can people find you on the internet?
go6.si. You can send me an email to jan@go6.si.
Yep.
And I will probably respond in a week or two.
And we are hoping that Jan will put some blog posts up on Packet Pushers about his IPv6 adventures in the near future and tell us more about what's happening. Because one of the reasons I wanted to bring Jan onto the show was to talk more about what's happening in the guts of IPv6 and expose some of that stuff that we don't get to see. We only see the results. We don't see the stuff going in the horse's head. We only see it coming out the horse's back.
Yeah.
So let's try and get some visibility about what happens inside the ITF horse, if you like. So thank you very much for coming on the show, Jan. And of course, Ivan, thank you again.
Thank you.
Where can we find you on the internet?
iosHints.info or Twitter at iosHints.
We'll look forward to seeing you there real soon. And of course, I'm Greg Farrow. You can find me at etherealmind.com or on the Twitter as @etherealmind. We'd love to hear your feedback about today's show, so send an email to packetpushers@gmail.com and let us know what you're thinking. Alternatively, you can check out the podcast website at http://packetpushers.net, leave comments on the blog post that publishes the show, or follow us on the Twitter as @packetpushers. And remember that too much networking would never